The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the Washington Post and the News and Observer. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we're going to allow veteran travel writer, Andrea Sachs, to share Roughing It in Style. That's the headline. And she shares that going on a camping and glamping trip out west where luxury is down to earth. Well, her article originally was published in the Washington Post and also appeared in the June 12th, 2022 online edition of the News and Observer. So we step back to enjoy this particular travel article. At Montpelier Canyon Campground in southern Idaho, heavy rain pummeled my tent, the drops sounding like tiny angry fist. A small lake formed by my toes. Temperatures plunged, forcing me to burrow inside my sleeping bag. In the morning, a sliver of sunshine seeped through a gap in the fabric. I crawled out of my tunnel, yanked off the rain fly, and returned to my sleeping pad, basking in the honeyed warmth. After days of wrestling with the elements, that burst of sunlight did more than gnaw my nose and raise my spirits. I should say thaw my nose, not gnaw. It elevated my camping experience from basic to luxury, an upgrade courtesy of nature. Of course, I could have gone straight to a higher plane of camping by spending all my time out west at Conestoga Ranch, a glamorous Utah camping resort about 40 miles south of the Idaho campground. But in the name of Nietzsche, would I have truly appreciated the property's porcelain throne and claw-foot tub if I hadn't persevered through vault toilets and baby wipe baths? Well, camping is about getting back to nature, testing yourself, and not always being comfortable. It's about being part of the environment, said Kelly Davis, director of research at the Outdoor Industry Association. With glamping, you're paying to extract the discomfort from the outdoors. You might have a nice hike and sit by the campfire, but you will sleep in a queen-size bed and maybe give up a TV. Maybe. When I set out for the mountain states over Memorial Day weekend, I imagined that my camping experiences would fall along the clear-cut lines. I would rough it at the primitive site for the first half and luxuriate at the glamping property for the final two nights, but nature proved me wrong. Next session, section titled Primitive Camping in Idaho. Several days before flying to Salt Lake City, my co-camper and I dusted off our outdoor survival skills. Christian opened a can of tomato soup using his pocket-sized multi-tool, and I taught myself to French braid my hair. Together, we raised my two-person tent, which had been rolling around in my car trunk for the better part of a decade. Two of the three practices required YouTube tutorials, a commodity not available at the campground in the more than 3 million-acre Caribou Targhee National Forest. Nor would we have cell phone service, electricity, or running water, hence the braiding lesson. Well, despite a prolonged drought, Montpelier Canyon was carpeted in many shades of green. A distant peak wore a milk mustache of snow. At the campground, which abutted Highway 89, tall willow trees and shaggy sagebrush helped mute the whoosh of traffic and hum of RV generators. Our campsite set at 9 o'clock on a cul-de-sac. Only visible neighbors resided at 3 o'clock, and they never seemed to be home. Christian and I pitched our tent on a smooth patch of ground that gently sloped toward Montpelier Creek, a popular trout fishing spot. Magpies dropped by to share their unsolicited opinions, and ducks with some place to be hawked overhead. We drove to Montpelier, a speck of a town that Mormon pioneers settled in 1860s, and Butch Cassidy robbed in 1896, galloping off with more than $7,100 in valuables from a bank in Montpelier. The former financial institution houses the free Butch Cassidy Museum, if you want to stop by. At Brulam Supermarket, the area's most abundant grocery store, we stocked up on items that we could grill on the fire ring, plus a few prepared meals in case frightful weather forced us to close the kitchen. At checkout, I asked the kid bagging groceries if the weekend forecast, 80 to 100% chance of rain, temps in the high 30s, possible snow, was it accurate or an exaggeration? And added, he said dryly, the weather in Idaho is bipolar. Well, back at the campground, Christian built the fire while I set out on a reconnaissance mission. The 15 sites were occupied by an even split of tent campers and RVers. On a message board near the entrance, I read the rules. Bag your fish heads and innards. Secure your food to avoid unwelcome visits from wild animals. And don't use the faucet for bathing or washing dishes. My hopes rose, then fell. Clearly, the printout was a standardized form posted at all the campgrounds, regardless of individual amenities. Well, on the return walk, I checked out the pit toilet. I've seen much worse at outdoor festivals, and scanned the creek for trout. Just rocks. At the edge of our campsite, I cocked an ear toward the mountains and listened to a chorus of howls. Yep. Those are coyotes, the campground host confirmed during her evening watch. I asked about other possible wildlife encounters in the vicinity. Cougars, or we call them mountain lions here, she said. If you walk to the other side of the campground and look at the mountain, you can see the caves they live in. Follow-up question, what should I do if a mountain lion pops by? Well, get into your car as quickly as you can. After she drove off, I checked the doors on the rental car, all unlocked. Christian had downloaded an HBO series on his phone, Our One Urban Transgression. Tucked into our sleeping bags, we slid his gadget into a pouch in the tent ceiling so we could watch horizontally, like mummies at a screen on the green. We were halfway through the first episode when the rain started falling. It grew heavier and louder, drowning out the dialogue. Camping is about improvising and problem-solving through any genius or harebrained means. For cookware substitutes, we used a game board as a cutting board, my wool mittens as oven mitts, and a branch-and-pan combo as a spatula. To overcome our audio issue, we simply activated the closed captioning. Crisis averted. In the wee hours, a blazing light filled the tent and woke me up. I poked my head out, expecting to see a car with its headlights on. I looked up and blinked. The sky was burning bright with hundreds of stars set on the highest wattage. Storms started to sweep through the area early in the morning. We set out for the first cluster at the Ranch Hand Trail Stop, a diner for outsized appetites. We got a lot of truckers, and they can't even finish the smaller portion of pancakes, the waitress told us, consoling Christian, who barely put a dent in his stack of 14 inches. That's a big pancake, isn't it? Well, we drove through Bear Lake National Wildlife Refuge, lowering the rain-splattered windows to snap photos of white pelicans and a bald eagle standing as still as a statue on a wooden pole. At Bear Lake, a father and his three sons, polar bear plunged into the Caribbean of the Rockies, a nickname that refers to the water's azure color, not its tropical temperatures. If I could only take a hot shower after the swim, but you see my campground, I said in response to their invitation to join them. Well, in the final hours, I grew wistful about leaving the campground. I would miss the singing coyotes, the sunbathing, the tent in golden rays, and the bottomless bowl of stars. A raindrop on my sleeping bag interrupted my reverie. I stretched my arm out of the tent and started pulling up the stakes. Next section, glamping in Utah. At Conestoga Ranch, I stood in the parking lot and eyeballed the distance from the car to our tent. Perched on the far reaches of a hill, a manageable walk, especially with my lightened load and slightly lower elevation of 5,968 feet. As I was consolidating my bag, Seth, the general manager who favored a park ranger's pallet, cruised up on an electric golf cart. Not one to pass up a chauffeured ride, I tossed my backpack and myself into the vehicle. The seasonal resort opened 7 years ago with 14 Conestoga wagons and 26 canvas tents on the Beehive State side of Bear Lake. Co-owner Larry Bettino said the tents were inspired by African safari camps, rugged structures containing opulent interiors like inside-out Fabergé eggs. He added that the idea of liberating guests from camping duties stemmed from a family vacation at an upscale fishing retreat in Idaho, where the staff handled all of the heavy lifting. People want to be able to camp and get the camping experience without having to put in all the effort, he told me a few days after my visit. If you don't want to cook, we have a restaurant. The tents are cleaned daily by our staff. We will start and tend the fire for you. The property overlooking Bear Lake, plus an unsightly flurry of developments, offers four tent styles and ascending levels of luxury. I booked the top-shelf option, the Royal Tent Suite, which came with everything the Montpelier Canyon campground didn't: heat, Wi-Fi, electricity, and modern plumbing. Seth parked by our private deck and unzipped the front door for the theatrical reveal. A king-size bed dressed in pristine white linens. A daring color choice, I thought, as I glanced at the mud on my shoes and the soot on my clothes. He showed us how to use the pellet stove, which we would employ for heat but not cooking. "Text if you run low," he said as we peered into a bin of brimming with wood snubs. We followed him past the mini-fridge, around a partial wall, and into the palatial bathroom, where a rain shower in a tin wash basin and a claw-footed tub threatened to derail my plans to bike along the lake trail. We circled back to the deck, where logs lay in a fire pit, ready for a light. Not ignited by me, of course, but by the campfire valet. At check-in, I received a bag with s'mores fixings, but even with that prop, I still forgot to schedule a fire starter for that evening. Once I was in the tent, the main lodge seemed so, well, far away. Instead, I texted my request in between courses at the Campfire Grill, the on-site restaurant with its own roaring fire. "Yes, someone can light your fire at that time," an employee responded minutes before the server delivered a heaping plate of grilled vegetables and quinoa. I hadn't even kicked off my boots when I noticed a golf cart putting up the path to the Royal. A teenager in a baseball cap and medical boot hopped out and hobbled over. While Trent built our fire on bent knees, we chatted about his injured leg, which he had broken on a trampoline during a senior trip. He said he would return later to douse our fire. According to house rules, guests must extinguish their fires by 11 p.m. 6 minutes after curfew, Trent reappeared, this time on foot. Under his watchful gaze, we threw a bucket of water on the flames. The blaze sizzled, then vanished faster than the Wicked Witch of the West. After all of the pampering, I started to feel slightly alienated from the natural world, so we decided to incorporate more rugged activities and shoulder more of the camping responsibilities. We drove up to Logan Canyon and hiked the 1.4-mile Limber Pine Nature Trail. At the ranch, I had spotted one deer twice. In the forest, nutcrackers fluttered by, their wings seemingly dipped in ink pots. A golden-mantled ground squirrel, squatting on a log sternly, contemplated us. For dinner, we resurrected our aluminum foil and my mittens, and we grilled vegetables and salmon at a communal rendezvous barbecue tent. During a rain delay, I received a text informing us that no staff would be available for fire duty after 9 p.m. However, we could light our own if we wished. With the last campfire of the trip, we made and burned s'mores, popped and burned popcorn, and boiled water for tea, a skill we had mastered in Idaho. We slept with the flaps open, holding nature as close as possible. At dawn, I opened my eyes and saw golden streaks over Bear Lake. My gaze fell on the pellet stove, which had turned cold, but instead of relighting it, I did what any intrepid camper would do. I wriggled deeper under the covers. Now, writer Andrea Sachs did add some additional information about some of the campsites she visited, so if you'd like to go, where would you stay? Well, there's Montpelier Canyon Campground. She says it's off Highway 89, just a few miles from Montpelier, Idaho. And the campground in the Caribou Targhee National Forest has 15 sites, most of which can accommodate tents and RVs. The camping destination is primitive, with no drinking water, electricity, cell phone service, or bathroom facilities beyond a vault toilet. Each site comes with a fire pit. You can buy supplies in Montpelier. If you camp on the weekend, stock up beforehand because most stores are closed Sundays. Now, nightly fee during the season late May through September is $10 plus an $8 service fee if you reserve online. Sites are free and first come, first served during off-season. And online you can check out this type of campground at bit.ly/Montpelier, M-O-N-T-P-E-L-I-E-R-Canyon, bit, bit.ly/Montpelier-Canyon. Next is Conestoga Ranch. Conestoga is spelled Conestoga. It's at 427 Paradise Parkway in Garden City, Utah. This glamping resort, which is open late May through September, offers a variety of accommodations, including Conestoga wagons and canvas tents that can accommodate 2, 4, or 6 people. Guests in the traditional tents and wagons use the public bathhouse by the main lodge. All other tents, family, couples, royal, have private ensuite bathrooms. Now, tents are furnished with beds, pellet stove, mini fridge, and fire pit. Rate includes golf cart luggage transport, fire starting assistance, s'mores kit, weekend yoga, and loaner cruiser bikes that are ideal for pedaling to nearby Bear Lake. You can cook out at one of the communal grills. The camp store sells charcoal, lighter fluid, and other essentials. Or dine at the on-site campfire grill, which serves daily breakfast starting at about $8, and dinner, wood-fired pizza and burgers start at $18, and other entrees from $22 and up. Now, tents started about $169. For the Royal Tent Suite in late May, I paid about $600. That included taxes and resort fee. Quite a trip there, huh? Well, now that Andrea Sachs has us out west, let's take an epic trip along the west coast. Now, here are the top 10 places, according to writer Christopher Reynolds. He originally wrote this for the Los Angeles Times, and his article was later published in the June 2, 2024 online edition of the News and Observer. I couldn't help it. In the course of scouting out great adventures for West Coast 101, our new guides to essential destinations in Baja California, Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia, I found myself compiling a personal top 10. I'll get to that list shortly, but first an honorable mention. But even if you've never seen The Big Lebowski, you've probably heard someone mention the rug that tied Lebowski's room together. Well, Harris Ranch does that for California. The I-5 stop for gas, food, lodging, bathrooms, not necessarily in that order, might not make anyone's bucket list. And I'll admit that if the wind blows the wrong way, it smells like cattle. But if you're driving north-south through the San Joaquin Valley, which just about every Californian does sooner or later, you're going to need to stop somewhere. Now, Harris Ranch faithfully awaits, 184 miles south of San Francisco and 200 miles north of L.A. City Hall, the pride of Coalinga, over the years, I pumped gas at its Shell station, slept in its comfortable hotel, no resort fee or room tax, conducted interviews in its horseshoe lounge, lingered over breakfast in its ranch kitchen, by the way, excellent, and grabbed a sandwich from its express barbecue, adequate. I've even bought bonsai from Hyo Kim, who peddles delicately coiffed junipers, olive, and pine trees between $25 and $500 from a stand on the dirt shoulder across the street. I'm not saying cattle ranches are good for the planet's future, definitely not, but I'm just realizing that for about 45 years now, Harris Ranch has been the rug tying together my adventures in the vast living room that is our West Coast. Your rug might be different. After all, these lists are subjective. Of our 101 best West Coast experiences, these 10 resonate most for me. I'd recommend them to just about any California newbie, and I'd grab at a chance to visit them again, some for basic beauty, others for the stories they tell or the memories they tie together. And so Reynolds does this in order of 10 to 1, so we'll start with number 10, which is the Rady Shell in San Diego. I have a hard time imagining a more pleasant place to see an outdoor concert. Well, maybe the Red Rocks Amphitheater outside Denver. But on the West Coast, well, I'll take this sleek Bayside Shell in downtown San Diego. And I'll try not to be resentful that nobody thought of this while I lived down there. And I have seen that shell myself. In fact, as I was walking along the bay a few years ago near a big marina, I was able to hear a concert. Never paid a dime for it, but I heard the music as I walked in that area. So it's quite a nice place just to take a walk. Number 9 is the Degens Big Sur in California. What are we going to do about Highway 1? Well, since the Coast Road was built on the slopes of Big Sur in the 1930s, we've treasured it. But as any aquaphobe, geologist, or engineer could tell you, those slopes crumble and slide relentlessly. Year after year, Caltrans moves mountains to keep that two-lane road navigable. Then comes another slide. Since January 2023, it's been impossible to drive from San Simeon to Big Sur via the coastal route. Caltrans has forecast reopening with some delays on May 27th. Whenever I worry about the highway, I think of DGENS, which is basically a roadside time capsule clad in weathered wood. It opened about the time the highway did and won over generations of road trippers with its rustic rooms and restaurant. Before Helmuth DGEN died in 1972, he set up a nonprofit organization to keep the place running in old-school fashion. I've been shopping there since the 1980s. You have to call to make a reservation, and when you get there, you have to expect paper-thin walls along with the Norwegian woodwork, the crackle of the fireplace, and the portrait of DGEN on the wall. It's a priceless place, and Nepenthe and the Henry Miller Memorial Library are just down the road. We just can't take DGEN's or that road for granted. Number 8 is Yosemite Valley, California. Does this need explaining? Well, probably not. If you're arriving from the south, you emerge from the long, dark Warwana Tunnel to see El Capitan and the Half Dome looming above a green, wet world of its own. Waterfalls roar left and right. The valley stretches for 7 miles, framed by granite walls that Ansel Adams had to shoot and Alex Honnold had to climb. The Merced River meanders through. Even if you don't have $600 to spend a night at the Awane Hotel, you can pop up for a snack, gaze up at painted rafters that go back to 1927, and warm yourself by one of the big fireplaces. At number 7, Venice Beach, Los Angeles. Yeah, I know, there's plenty to lament in Venice, but when you hit that beach at the right time on the right day, it feels so emblematic of Southern California. On my last visit, the sun was just setting. My wife, Mary Frances, and I checked out the skateboarders, chatted with a few artists who were selling work along the sidewalk, and did a double take on the shul on the beach, a.k.a. Pacific Jewish Center, an Orthodox synagogue where worshipers were just gathering for a Friday night Shabbat meal. Number 6, the whales of Baja's lagoons. It's one thing to watch migrating gray whales off the Southern California coast, standing at the rail of a big boat, looking for spouts in the distance and perhaps drawing within 100 yards. It's something else when you're in a panga on the waters of a southern Baja lagoon, usually Ojo de Libre, Scammons, or San Ignacio. These immense creatures, the cows and the calves, get so close sometimes it feels intimate and maybe a little scary. The adults weigh up to 90,000 pounds. Number 5, the Ferry Building and Waterfront San Francisco. I'm trying to think of a more successful architectural resurrection than San Francisco's Ferry Building, and failing. Picture that 1898 waterfront building in the 1920s when there was no Bay Bridge and no Golden Gate Bridge, and up to 50,000 people per day were commuting by ferry. The ferry building at the foot of Market Street was the center of the Bay Area's nervous system. Then the bridges went up, commuters abandoned the ferries, the building was rehabbed into ugly offices, and decades passed. Finally, in the aftermath of the 1989 Loma Prieta quake, San Francisco leaders launched a plan to revive the building. It reopened in 2003 as a foodie-oriented restaurant and retail space, 1,000 times more interesting to me than the souvenir shops of Fisherman's Wharf and Pier 39, although at least you get the sight and sound of the sea lions there. Apart from the food, it's got great views of the Bay Bridge, and with luck, that bridge's nightly light show, which went dark last year, will resume in early 2025. I think of the ferry building and the Golden Gate Bridge as the bookends of the waterfront. Number 4 is the Hidden Valley Joshua Tree National Park. I'm not a rock climber or boulderer, but I'm a sucker for sunrises and sunsets in the desert, and that's what golden hour light hits the jumbled boulders in Hidden Valley. It's hard not to see it. Well, number 3 is Pike Place Market, Seattle, and one of my favorites as well, by the way, in my travel experiences. This is always the first place I want to go in Seattle, a spot where people, colors, flavors, and scents all come together. I walk past the mirrored bar at the Athenian restaurant where my buddy Rick and I had beers in 1986, my first time in town. I go down below to make sure the bubblegum wall is still in place. I'm on the spot where the newsstand used to be. I kick myself for failing to buy an incredibly cool cigar box guitar from the Soul Cat guitar guy when I had the chance. I thought I'd have another chance at his market stall when I visited in January, but he wasn't there that day. I listen to buskers and eat unhealthy snacks. I stick my head in the Anarchist Collective Bookshop, Left Bank Books is the official name, which has somehow lasted 51 years. And like every other tourist, I linger near the fishmonger so I can see them flinging fish and hollering at each other. And literally, I had a pretty sizable fish fly over my head when my visit there. Now, number two is Capilano Suspension Bridge Park in Vancouver. On my first visit a few years ago, it was raining and the park was packed. I wondered if the bridge would be closed. Nope. Open and prone to slightly jiggle as I stood 230 feet above the Capilano River, surrounded by tall trees and mist. When I returned in February, it was snowing, the park was nearly empty, and the bridge was still open. The vibe was part Twin Peaks, part Indiana Jones, and the Temple of Doom. And number one, Badwater Death Valley. Now, Badwater is hot and dry enough to kill you pretty quickly, but as long as you have water to drink, a little shade, and a way out, you'll probably live and have a story to tell. On my first visit a summer day about 30 years ago, Death Valley was even hotter than usual, around 115 degrees. The power had gone out at our Furnace Creek Hotel. Rather than crowd into the marginally cooler hotel pool with scores of young children and their urine, most likely, I headed with my wife and friends for the vast, flat, salty, dry lake floor of Badwater with a wiffle bat and a ball. The game didn't last long, but there are photos. Except for our 20th century leisure wear, we looked like biblical figures in the process of being turned to pillars of salt. So last year, when rains washed out roads, closed Death Valley National Park for months, refilled the lake bed, and transformed the basin into a big mirror, I was eager to get back there. Now, it has reopened, and I should say I just heard a report recently where they're looking at a record hot temperature for Death Valley about the time we're recording this in mid-July, and I'm telling you, they're talking about 130 degrees. That's quite a record. I understand they recently set a record with 125 degrees there. Woo! That's hot. Well, let's end today's journey visiting the birthplace of a teddy bear, Andrea Finnegan's article appearing in the August 18, 2023 issue of the Washington Post. And if you own a stuffed animal with a yellow stife tag pinned to its ear, you have a descendant of one of the first teddy bears. While the stuffed bears were eventually named for President Theodore Roosevelt, part of their origin can be traced to Germany when a woman named Margaret Steiff. Now, she founded her company in Gingen, Germany in 1880. Steiff, who contracted polio when she was 18 months old, was paralyzed in her legs and had limited use of her right arm, but she became a master seamstress and ran a felt clothing business. Her first animal creation was a small felt elephant, which was intended to be a pincushion. The Steiff catalog expanded to include other animals like monkeys, giraffes, and rabbits. It became an instant success in the U.S., the story goes on, and the stuffed toy later got its teddy name thanks to a cartoon depicting Roosevelt refusing to shoot a bear in the Washington Post in 1902. About the same time, Brooklyn candy shop owner and inventor Morris Mickham also began making and selling teddy bears in Roosevelt's honor. So there you go, a little information about teddy bears when you think about them. Okay? My friends, that brings us to the end of today's journey of Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading from the North Carolina Reading Service, and remind you that the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice, all one word, .org. If you have any comments or questions, you may direct them to 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.